19. The Seventh Disinformation Operation, Democratization in Czechoslovakia in 1968. The Western Interpretation. As reported in the Communist and Western press, the leaders of the Communist Party introduced certain economic and political reforms in Czechoslovakia during 1968. In the economy, greater independence was given to factory managers. The profit motive and market-oriented practices were partially reintroduced. Sensational developments occurred in the political field. Communist sources revealed that an intensive struggle was fought out in the party leadership between the conservatives, or Stalinists, led by the general secretary, President Novotny, and the liberals, or progressives, led by the secretary of the Slovak Communist Party, Dubček. In January 1968, the liberals won and Dubček replaced Novotny as the country's leader. The new regime disclosed certain crimes committed by the former party leadership, denounced the cult of personality the former leaders had practiced, allegedly reduced to some degree the role of the security services, and broadened the political rights of the population. Censorship was abolished, intellectuals were given greater freedom, opportunities for foreign travel were improved, and even the possibility of permitting the formation of non-communist political parties was discussed. The Soviet Union, alarmed by these developments, denounced them as counter-revolutionary. In August, Warsaw Pact troops invaded Czechoslovak territory without meeting resistance from the Czechoslovak army. The political situation was reversed. Dubček and other liberals were replaced by Soviet puppets. Western journalists, scholars, and officials, basing their interpretation largely on accounts of these events in communist sources, accepted the Czechoslovak crisis as an attempt at a spontaneous, peaceful democratic revolution. They accepted as genuine the power struggle between progressives and conservatives. They accepted Dubček's reforms as a new brand of democratic socialism with a human face. Indignation at the occupation of Czechoslovakia by forces of the Warsaw Pact evoked deep sympathy for Dubček, his regime, and his new brand of socialism. Four additional factors contributed to Western acceptance of the liberalization of the Czechoslovak regime at face value. First, the liberalization took place in a country that had had strong democratic traditions before the communist coup in February 1948, and the liberalization seemed like a revival of those traditions. Second, the Czechoslovak leaders seemed to have gone further than any other communist leaders in their criticism of the Soviet Union, in their preparedness to permit non-communist parties, and in their denunciations of the crimes of former Soviet and Czechoslovak security officials against non-communist statesmen, such as Jan Masaryk, the former foreign minister. Third, extreme Soviet pressure was exercised on the Dubček regime through the Soviet press and through conspicuous movements of Warsaw Pact forces on the Polish-Czechoslovak border. Fourth, there was a close apparent parallel between events in Czechoslovakia in 1968 and those in Hungary in 1956.1 according to the Western interpretation of events. The overthrow of the Novotny regime by the progressives was brought about through the alliance of some liberal-minded economists and dissenting intellectuals with a few progressive communist leaders, such as Dubček. Weak as it was, this alliance succeeded in carrying out a democratic revolution against the totalitarian regime, enjoying the support of the armed forces and security services without the firing of a single shot. Western errors. A major error in most Western assessments of Czechoslovakia in 1968 was to consider the events of that year in isolation from the recent past. Unfortunately, failing to appreciate the changes in relations within the bloc and the adoption of the long-range policy between 1957 and 1960, they used outdated methodology in their interpretation of events. Failing also to take into account the systematic dissemination of disinformation through sources under communist control, including the communist press and communist officials and intellectuals, they placed excessive reliance on these sources. A reinterpretation of Czechoslovak democratization. The new methodology dictates a new and opposite interpretation of Czechoslovak democratization. It sees it not as a spontaneous development, but as a planned, controlled maneuver and rehearsal for a similar development, all to take place within the framework of the long-range policy. The major argument in favor of this view is that Czechoslovak democratization fitted into and met the requirements of communist strategy for Western Europe. A second argument is that, throughout the upheavals of 1968, Czechoslovakia remained an active member of Comecon and the Warsaw Pact. The Czechoslovak party leaders, their security and intelligence services, and the regime as a whole actively participated in the formulation, adoption, and implementation of the long-range block policy in the period 1958 to 1960. Novotny frequently consulted with the Soviet leaders, especially Khrushchev, in this period, and Novotny and his colleagues, notably Hendrik, the party official responsible for ideology and work with intellectuals, played a key role in the formulation of the policy insofar as it related to Czechoslovakia. A Czechoslovak party delegation led by Novotny took part in the 81 Party Congress in Moscow in November 1960, which adopted the long-range bloc policy and strategy for the international communist movement. There are indications that the special strategic role for Czechoslovakia had been worked out, at least in outline, by 1960, and that preparations for the maneuver began immediately thereafter. In May 1961, Dubček visited the Soviet Union and was received by Suslov. 2. In June and July, a delegation of Czechoslovak party workers led by Lenart went to the Soviet Union to study the work of the CPSU. In June 1962, Novotny led another party delegation to the Soviet Union. 4. Coordination between the Czechoslovak, Soviet, and other bloc intelligence and security services over their political role in the implementation of the long-range bloc policy began in 1959. The Minister of the Interior, Barak, and other members of his ministry attended the Conference of Bloc Security and Intelligence Services in Moscow in that year. Thereafter, the Czechoslovak services became members of the Intelligence and Security Coordinating Center for the Bloc. From 1959 to 1968, Novotny and his Minister of the Interior, Barak, until 1961, were actively working on the dissolution of genuine political opposition and the creation of false, controlled opposition in Czechoslovakia, on the lines introduced and practiced in the Soviet Union by Shelepin. Dissolution of genuine opposition was tackled largely by rehabilitations and amnesties. The Novotny regime carried out amnesties in 1960, 1962, 1964, and 1965, the most extensive being the one in 1960 in which most of the state criminals were freed. The last amnesty, in 1968, was carried out under Dubček, who was thus continuing a policy already established by Novotny and Barak. The role of historians and economists in democratization. A close parallel developed in the period 1959 to 1968 between the approach adopted by Khrushchev and Shelepin to the use of writers, economists, historians, other intellectuals, and rehabilitated party members in activist political work and the approach adopted by the Czechoslovak leaders. The indications are that a false opposition was created in Czechoslovakia and that the struggle between alleged liberals and alleged conservatives was staged on the pattern established in the Soviet Union by Khrushchev and Shelepin. In 1963, the Central Committee of the Czechoslovak Communist Party set up two commissions of experts. One was a commission of 36 historians under Gustav Husák, then vice president of the Council of Ministers. The other was a group of economists under Oda Sik, who later became a vice premier in the Dubček government. The Central Committee made the party's secret archives and statistics available to the two commissions. The date 1963 is significant in that it was 3 years after the adoption of the long-range bloc policy and 5 years before the so-called democratization took place. The commissions were established in the Novotny period. Husák and Sik subsequently figured prominently in the democratization and its reversal. Putting these facts together, the conclusion may be drawn that the commissions were established under Novotny's leadership within the framework of the long-range policy to prepare the groundwork for the events of 1968. There is a strong pointer to Soviet-Czechoslovak coordination in the matter in that the Economic Commission was established by Novotny at Khrushchev's suggestion. Soviet historians were mobilized in support of long-range policy in the Soviet Union during the same period, though in a different manner. Academician Kvostov played an important part in this activity. The roles of Barak and Sik. Barak's role, his dismissal in February 1962, and his rehabilitation and reappearance in 1968 can be completely reinterpreted. Barak was Minister of the Interior from 1953 to 1961 and a member of the Presidium of the Party from 1954 until February 1962. As Minister of the Interior, he played an important part in the formulation of the long-range policy and was in close liaison with the chairman of the KGB, Shelepin. The chief of the KGB Institute, General Kurenkov, informed the staff and students of the KGB Institute in Moscow in 1959-60, after the return of a KGB delegation to Czechoslovakia of which he was a member, that the KGB had closer relations with the Czechoslovak Security Service than with any other service in the bloc. Significantly, the young technocrats and planners who became members of the Economic Commission in 1963 and played key roles in the introduction of economic reforms in 1968, including Otis Sik, were close to Barak in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Given Barak's connection at the time with the planning of the long-range policy and the new role of the security and intelligence services in it, it is likely that even then the young technocrats were being prepared for their part in introducing controlled democratization. On February 9, 1962, it was announced in the Czechoslovak press that Barak had been arrested and sentenced to 15 years imprisonment for embezzlement of public funds. He was released in May 1968 with the explanation that the funds were not embezzled at all but were intended for the Czechoslovak intelligence service. Barak himself indicated that his removal was due to Novit New York's fear of being the victim of the young technocrats and economic planners by whom he, Barak, liked to be surrounded. 7. Given Barak's involvement in long-range policy formulation in 1959 to 1961. It is likely that his arrest in February 1962 was fictitious and was used to mislead Western analysts about the true nature of his relations with technocrats like Sik. It could also have been used to fabricate for this leading secret policeman a reputation as a liberal reformer and a victim of Novotny, the better to explain his reappearance under the new regime of 1968. There was a further possible motive for the staging of Barak's arrest. In the course of compiling their damage report on the author's defection in December 1961, the KGB would have discovered that the author was aware of the close liaison between the leaders of the KGB and of the Czechoslovak Security Service under Barak. A likely speculation is that, instead of spending his time in jail from 1962 to 1968, Barak was sent secretly to Moscow to represent the Czechoslovak government in the bloc's Intelligence and Security Coordinating Center. His reappearance in Czechoslovakia in May 1968 would have been to act as a behind-the-scenes coordinator of the developments of that year. As a key man at the planning stage of those developments, he would have been needed on the spot during the crucial period of their unfolding. Given Sik's relations with Barak and his appointment as head of the Economic Commission by the Central Committee of the party in 1963 under Novotny's leadership, his role in the introduction of economic reforms, his support for Dubček in 1968, and his participation in the Dubček government should be regarded not as a spontaneous personal activity, but as the fulfillment of a party assignment within the framework of the long-range policy. It was probably no coincidence that his appointment in 1963 fell within the same period as the emergence in the Soviet Union of a liberal economist, Professor Lieberman. Sik, in fact, became known as the Czechoslovak Lieberman. The role of writers and democratization. An understanding of Sik's party role in introducing economic reforms in Czechoslovakia, together with an understanding of the Soviet party's use of Tvardovsky and Kochetov as the leaders of the liberal and conservative factions among Soviet writers, helps toward an understanding of the role of Czechoslovak writers in the democratization of 1968. Since Khrushchev advised the Czechoslovak party to set up an economic commission in 1963, it is not unlikely that he or Shelepin advised the Czechoslovak party and security service to use their writers in a controlled liberalization, in the same way as they themselves had used Tvardovsky and Kochetov. Czechoslovak writers played an important part in the alleged removal of Novotny and his replacement by Dubček. For example, at the Writers' Congress in May-June 1967, the liberal Slovak writer Ludvík Vakulík, a member of the Central Committee, a member of the staff of Literárny listy, and a confidant of Dubček, delivered several lectures advocating more creative freedom. In a plea for democratic socialism, he also called for an active struggle against neo-Stalinists. The Slovak writer Nako attacked Novotny. Anton Lehm, one of the founders of Literárny noviny, spoke against censorship and police despotism. Another writer read out to the Congress Solzhenitsyn's secret letter against censorship. The criticism of neo-Stalinism was convincing. But Vakulík, Klíma, and Lehm, who participated in this criticism and called for democratization, were all members of the Central Committee of the party at the time. This raises at least a possibility that they were acting, like Tvardovsky and Kochetov, on the instructions of the party. It is interesting that, 3 months later, in September 1967, these writers were expelled from the party for spreading anti-communist propaganda at the Writers' Congress. Knowing the methods of provocation used by communist security services, the expulsions can be interpreted as deliberate steps to build up the image of these writers as independent, spontaneous critics of the regime and genuine exponents of democratic socialism. At the same time, the expulsions would have served to cover up their secret party assignments. Some of the actions and speeches of the Czechoslovak writers, Vaculik's speech, for instance, were reminiscent of the actions and speeches of Hungarian writers in 1956. The question to be asked is whether the Czechoslovak writers' actions and speeches were truly spontaneous or whether they were deliberately modeled in advance on the Hungarian pattern by the Central Committee and its ideological department in preparation for the introduction of a program of controlled reform designed to stabilize the Czechoslovak regime and serve the purposes of bloc strategy in Europe. It is interesting that in his speech, Vaculik, after condemning the first Stalinist phase of the Czechoslovak regime, referred to the second phase in which democratic socialism would be realized. It is possible to detect in this a hint of forward planning. It could well be that these speeches were prepared by the writers in conjunction with the Commission of Historians set up in 1963. Vaculik himself revealed in March 1967, 2 to 3 months before the Writers' Congress, that he had been present at a meeting of the ideological department of the Central Committee at which questions on freedom for creative activities were discussed. Vaculik and other writers published a manifesto titled 2,000 Words in the weekly Literarni Listi on June 27, 1968.8. This later became the credo of the party Progressives and was used by the Soviets and other orthodox communists to denounce them as counter-revolutionaries. Some of the statements in it reveal the kind of democratization the authors had in mind. While identifying themselves with the party Progressives, they called for support for the party functionaries and security organs and respect for Czechoslovakia's treaties of friendship with its allies, i.e., the Soviet Union and other countries of the Warsaw Pact. The following are a few quotations. In the first place, we will oppose the opinion, if it manifests itself, that a democratic rebirth can come without the communists or even against them. This would be not only unjust but unreasonable. The communists have well-established organizations. These organizations are necessary to sustain the tendencies of progress. They have experienced functionaries and they also have in hand the controls of command. They have prepared a program of action which has been proposed to the public. It is a program aiming at reparation of the greatest injustices and they are the only ones in possession of such a concrete program. Let us bring the National Front back to life. Let us give our support to the security agencies when they pursue criminal and common law delinquents. We have no intention of provoking anarchy or a general state of insecurity. And we give to our allies the assurance that we shall respect our treaties of friendship, alliance, and trade. Seen against the background of party and security service interest in introducing and controlling a process of democratization, these expressions of support for the party functionaries, security services, and the Warsaw Pact are clear indications of party guidance to the writers. The struggle between the Novotny conservatives and the Dubček progressives, if the liberal economists and writers are considered the first two moving forces behind the democratization of 1968. The third was the alleged struggle in the party leadership between the progressives led by Dubček and the conservatives led by Novotny, which culminated eventually in the victory of the progressives. Although Novotny was of the Stalinist generation and was brought up against the background of Stalin's and Gottwald's leadership of the Soviet and Czechoslovak Communist parties, he did not take over the leadership of the Czechoslovak party until after Stalin's death. And it was under his leadership, as under Khrushchev's in the Soviet Union, that an actual de-Stalinization of the Czechoslovak party took place in the period 1956-60, during which many party political prisoners were rehabilitated. It is questionable, therefore, whether the charges of neo-Stalinism brought against Novotny by the progressives were well-founded. The air of artificiality about them supports the thesis that they were contrived within the framework of the long-range policy and disinformation program in order to misrepresent as a spontaneous liberal upheaval what was in fact an orderly, planned, and controlled succession to a new generation of party leaders. Similarly, there are grounds for suggesting that Dubček was chosen and groomed for the role of Novotny's leading adversary in a calculated display of internal party differences serving the same purpose. Like Novotny, although junior to him in age and rank, Dubček was a product of the Stalinist party machine with a militant communist background. A Slovak by origin, he had intimate connections with the Soviet Union, where he lived from 1922 to 1938. In 1939, he joined the Czechoslovak Communist Party, in which he rose steadily during the last 14 years of Stalin's lifetime. In the year of Stalin's death in 1953, Dubček became party secretary of a town in Slovakia. According to Salomon, Dubček loved and respected the Soviet Union. Between 1955 and 1958, he studied at the High Party School, attached to the Central Committee of the CBSU in Moscow. This school selects and trains future leaders for the CBSU and other communist parties. Dubček was still there in 1958, the year in which the formulation of the long-range policy began. It could well be that it was in part because of his Russian background and training in this school that Dubček was chosen and groomed by the Central Committee as the leader of the progressives. Dubček was made a secretary of the Slovak Communist Party and a member of the Presidium in 1963, the same year in which Sik was appointed head of the Economic Commission and Husak head of the Commission of Historians. It may therefore be surmised that Dubček was chosen for his role in 1963. There are a number of anomalies in the story of the Quiet Revolution that raise serious doubts about its spontaneous nature. Some of the unanswered questions are as follows. Why did the conservative majority in the Presidium vote for Dubček, and why did Novotny himself not object to Dubček's candidacy? Why did the Central Committee and party machine controlled by Novotny's conservative supporters not prevent the replacement of Novotny by Dubček? Why did neither the conservative military and security leaders, like the Minister of Defense, Lomsky, and the head of military security, Mamula, nor the leaders of the shock troops and militia of Prague, which organized the coup d'etat in 1948, act against Dubček if there was a genuine risk that he might turn into a Czechoslovak Imre Nagy and threaten the foundations of their regime? Why did Hendrik, an ultra-conservative Novotny supporter, a frequent visitor to Moscow, the head of the party's ideological department, the controller of the country's intellectuals since 1958, in short, the Czechoslovak equivalent of Ilyichev, side with Dubček at the secret session of the Central Committee in January 1968 that nominated Dubček as general secretary? Why did all these conservatives accept Dubček without resistance when, if the revolution had been spontaneous, they would have stood to lose their heads? Why did not Dubček remove key officials like Lomsky or Mamula right at the beginning in March 1968? Why did the press censors themselves support democratization and vote against the censorship? Why was Novotny untouched after he had lost power, if he was such a villain? Why did the foreign policy of Dubček's regime follow the old, orthodox conservative line, anti-NATO, anti-USA, and anti-Israel? Why did the progressive leaders welcome the bloc's occupation troops? Had the Dubček regime been authentically democratic, it would have removed the orthodox party and security officials who had been responsible for past repression. In fact, only 300 persons in the Ministry of the Interior were allegedly discharged or demoted, mere drop in the bucket. By and large, the old guard went unscathed. Conservative and orthodox officials and new progressives, some of them former victims of conservative repression, served together in the new regime of democratic socialism. In fact, the major change was a return to the higher ranks of government of certain rehabilitated party members, whose rehabilitation was exploited to project a new image of the communist regime. Among them were Husak, vice premier, released in 1960, Smirkovsky, president of the National Assembly, released in 1955, and Pavel, minister of the Interior, released in 1955. Their return could well have been the realization of a calculated policy of rehabilitation carried out on Soviet lines. It should be remembered in this context that both Gomulka and Kádár, who rose to be the party leaders in Poland and Hungary respectively, were rehabilitated party members. A distinctive feature of rehabilitation in Czechoslovakia was that former communist officials were fully rehabilitated. Some of the non-communist political prisoners were not. The rehabilitation law adopted in June 1968 approved the review of individual cases but did not annul the court's decisions, lest, justly sentenced, authentic counter-revolutionary elements should be set free. Perhaps the most convincing evidence of the essential continuity between the old and new regimes is the fact that Gottwald, who was responsible for the Reign of Terror from 1948 onwards, involving, according to official statistics, the confinement of 130,000 persons, was not denounced as a criminal by the new regime. On the contrary, Dubček decorated the widows and orphans of martyred communist officials with the Order of Gottwald, under whose leadership their husbands and fathers had been executed. Strangely, the victim's relatives accepted these decorations. The controlled nature of democratization in Czechoslovakia shows up clearly when comparisons are made with Hungary in 1956. The Hungarian Revolution was a popular uprising. While it lasted, it dismantled the system, the party machine, and the security services. It replaced party leaders with non-party leaders. Some party leaders, like Imre Nagy, broke with the party and sided with the people. In Czechoslovakia, on the other hand, democratization was carried out by the party, hence the Quiet Revolution. Basically, the party machine, the army, and the security services were untouched. There was continuity, not a fundamental break, with the previous regime. Older communist leaders were replaced by younger communist leaders, so that the party's monopoly of power and ideology was not broken. The Hungarian Revolution occurred during the crisis of the communist bloc and was an expression of that crisis. The Czechoslovak Revolution occurred during the period of the bloc's recovery from crisis and exemplified the bloc's long-range policy in action. Some aspects of the Soviet reaction to events were a little strange. Despite the exchange of criticism between the Soviet and Czechoslovak leaders, they continued to visit one another's countries. Photographs appeared of Dubček and Brezhnev warmly embracing one another. Nothing is known about the talks that actually took place between them, other than a few hints inspired by the communist regimes themselves. In the West, this evidence of good relations between the Soviet and Czechoslovak leaders was either ignored or interpreted as a crude attempt to cover up the depth of the divisions between them. The revised interpretation of the Quiet Revolution, based on the new methodology, suggests that these meetings were used for consultation and coordination of the further action to be taken by each side. The movements of the Warsaw Pact troops on the Polish-Czechoslovak border, no doubt intended to recall events in Hungary in 1956, were too conspicuous to be accepted at face value. Their movement into Czechoslovakia was, on this analysis, an agreed measure of assistance to the regime by the bloc. As indeed the Czechoslovak party maintained at the time. 11, it was also an opportunity to season and rehearse troops from bloc countries in a punitive intervention in another communist country to stabilize its regime. Significantly, troops from those countries which had been most rebellious in the past, Poland, Hungary, and East Germany, were used in Czechoslovakia. But the primary purpose the intervention served was to drive home the lesson throughout Eastern Europe and the communist world that the United States and NATO were powerless to intervene, and that internal opposition in Czechoslovakia or any other communist country would be crushed. Conclusions. Given that the Czechoslovak leaders took part in the formulation of the new long-range bloc policy between 1958 and 1960. Given that their security and intelligence services were involved in the planning and preparation of activist political disinformation operations in support of this policy. Given the indications that the economic reforms of SIK and others were planned from 1963 onward under the Novotny regime. Given the indications that the Czechoslovak writers, in demanding democratization, were not acting spontaneously, but in accordance with their party role under Hendrik's guidance, given the anomalies in the democratization process and in the alleged struggle between progressives and conservatives, led respectively by Dubček and Novotny, the inescapable conclusion is that the Quiet Revolution was a controlled operation planned and conducted by the party apparatus itself with the benefit of recent parallel Soviet experience in the preparation of a false opposition movement. It cannot, of course, be denied that some political and economic reforms were carried out in 1968, but it would be erroneous to consider them either as spontaneous or as far-reaching and democratic, as the communist leaders made them out to be. They were calculated readjustments made on the initiative and under the control of the party, which had in hand the controls of command. 12 Goldstucker, one of the leading figures in democratization, put it bluntly to Salomon. We have tried to develop an effective control of power from within our own system. 13. The Quiet Revolution was an effective demonstration of the new, creative leading role of the party working through its economists, historians, writers, rehabilitated members, and alleged progressives, and using the techniques of political action and disinformation. It was radically unlike the spontaneous Hungarian Revolution. It represented a further stage in the extension of controlled disinformation operations throughout the bloc to serve the purposes of long-range policy and strategy. It had some purely local, Czechoslovak elements. Among these were, for example, the exposure of the Jan Masaryk affair, the whole story of which has not yet been told, the acceptance of non-communist parties controlled effectively by the regime, and the alleged removal of Novotny. More likely a natural retirement, as in Khrushchev's case, for reasons of age or health. Communist gains and losses from democratization. Undoubtedly, the Soviet government and the bloc as a whole lost prestige through their so-called intervention in Czechoslovakia. But the immediate and future advantages in terms of long-range bloc policy and strategy definitely outweighed the losses. Before 1968, there were acute problems in Czechoslovakia, which demanded solutions. The Communist Party, the regime, and its institutions were discredited and unpopular. There was a need for change in the party leadership. There was internal and external opposition to the regime. There was discontent among the intellectuals and formerly imprisoned party members. There was Slovak resentment at Czech domination. The unattractive stigma of the crushing of democracy in February 1948 still attached to communists in Western Europe and hampered their electoral collaboration with liberals and socialists. With the help and support of the leaders of the other bloc regimes, the Czechoslovak leaders developed communist solutions to these problems through calculated and controlled democratization. They succeeded in revitalizing the party, the regime, and its institutions and in giving them a new, more democratic image. They solved the succession problem without convulsions or a power struggle. They committed the younger party leaders to the continuation of the long-range policy and the strengthening of strategic coordination within the Warsaw Pact. 14 and the Quiet Revolution. They demonstrated their long-range approach to the selection and training of future leaders and to rotation of the candidates to create a reservoir of experience. They developed their own Czechoslovak version of the disinformation on de-Stalinization and power struggles used already by the Soviet, Chinese, and Yugoslav parties. They succeeded in confusing and, partially, in neutralizing internal and external opposition to the regime. 15. They neutralized discontent among the intellectuals by involving them as collaborators in their policy. They neutralized the discontent of the imprisoned party members by rehabilitating them and giving them leading roles. They neutralized Slovak discontent by bringing forward Slovaks Dubček and Husák as party leaders of Czechoslovakia and by increasing investment in the Slovak economy. In short, the Czechoslovak communist leaders succeeded in preserving and in fact strengthening the power and effectiveness of the regime while at the same time giving it a new image. Dubček was firmly identified at home and abroad with a new brand of socialism with a human face, acceptable to Western social democrats and liberals. Possible implications of democratization for the West. The Soviet, Czechoslovak, and bloc communist leaders and strategists gained valuable experience and insight into Western reactions to democratization in Czechoslovakia. The Dubček government, communist though it was, rapidly acquired a radically new image in the West. It was perceived not as an oppressive, totalitarian regime, tainted by the stigma of February 1948 and deserving to be scorned and shunned on that account, but as the harbinger of a new era of socialism with a human face, deserving to be encouraged and supported by all currents of opinion. The Dubček brand of communism deprived both conservatives and the moderate left of the argument that the acquisition of power by communist parties in Western Europe or elsewhere would lead automatically to the extinction of democracy as it did in Czechoslovakia in 1948. At the same time, it provided West European communist parties in particular with a powerful new propaganda weapon and a new basis for establishing united fronts with socialist parties in common opposition to capitalism and conservatism. In this context, it should be remembered that the international organ of the communist parties, the World Marxist Review, Problems of Peace and Socialism, is based on and is published in the Czechoslovak capital. In the short term, Dubček's departure was a setback for West European communist parties. Under Husák, the pendulum appeared to have swung back toward a more orthodox and traditional brand of communism. Nevertheless, the Dubček government aroused great Western expectations of possible future political evolution in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union and the emergence of new brands of communism. Indeed, it can be confidently expected that the experiment will be repeated both in Czechoslovakia, with or without Dubček, and on a broader scale in the final stage of the bloc's long-range policy. Future Prague Springs could well bring electoral victory for one or more West European communist parties. Provided those parties conform to the Dubček brand of communism, there is a real danger that socialist, moderate, and conservative opinion, failing to realize the true nature and strategic motives of Dubček's communism, will accept the situation with all its attendant dangers and potential consequences. It would be worthwhile for the West to study the scenario and techniques of the Czechoslovak experiment so as not to be taken in again as it was in 1968. The scenario could well be repeated, in essence, although with local variations. Its main constituents are therefore recapitulated here. A revival of de-Stalinization, together with publication abroad of the memoirs of former party and other political prisoners. Subsequent publication of these memoirs in the home country and of new exposures and revelations about the old regime, especially through the medium of prison literature. Rehabilitation of former party leaders. Stories of a struggle for power behind the scenes in the party leadership and the emergence of progressive and liberal leaders. A writers' congress with demands for greater freedom and the abolition of censorship. Production of controversial television programs, films, and novels. Emphasis on socialist legality and socialist democracy, emphasis on federalism rather than on centralism in relation to Slovakia. Expansion of commercial freedom and an increased role for economic and workers' councils and trade unions. Suppression of censorship in the press, radio, and television, with greater freedom for cultural and artistic activity. Formation of controlled non-communist parties and political clubs and organizations, such as Club 231. Reunions of political prisoners. Adoption of new laws on rehabilitation. Controlled student demonstrations. Secret meetings of the Central Committee and the choice of new, progressive leaders. Objectives of the Quiet Revolution. The staging of the Quiet Revolution and its reversal served a wide variety of strategic and tactical objectives. They can be summarized thus: to give a new, democratic image to the party, its institutions, and its leaders, and to increase thereby their influence, prestige, and popular appeal. To revitalize the party, the regime, and institutions, such as the National Front, the trade unions, press, and parliament, and to make them effective organs of power and control in the political and economic life of the country. To avoid a genuine crisis and popular revolt by provoking an artificial, controlled crisis through coordinated action by the party, the security services, the intellectuals, trade unions, and other mass organizations. To prevent the controlled crisis from becoming uncontrolled by the introduction of bloc troops into Czechoslovakia in a move planned with and agreed to in advance by the Czechoslovak leaders. To demonstrate the uselessness of opposition and the powerlessness of NATO and the United States to intervene. To provoke genuine internal and external opposition into exposing itself, and thereafter to neutralize or liquidate such opposition. The regime may well have found it convenient to get rid of a number of genuine anti-communists by allowing freedom of travel for a while. To rehearse the use of Warsaw Pact troops in stabilizing a Warsaw Pact country in case the need should arise to use them in another independent communist state, such as Romania, Albania, or Yugoslavia. To secure a smooth succession from the older to the younger generation of communist leaders. To ensure the unbreakable identification of the younger party leaders with, and their total personal commitment to, the long-range bloc policy initiated by the older generation. To provide the younger leaders with experience in handling controlled political developments. To increase their prestige at home and abroad as independent, national democratic leaders. To bridge the gap between the older and younger generations, and to appeal to the national sentiments of the younger generation in particular. To support and amplify bloc strategic disinformation on political evolution, the decay of ideology, the emergence of new brands of communism, and the disintegration of the bloc into independent, national regimes. To give the Romanian and Yugoslav regimes an opportunity to demonstrate their independence by criticizing the occupation of Czechoslovakia. To do the same for certain West European communist parties. To enable those parties to increase their electoral appeal by identifying themselves with socialism with a human face. To arouse sentiment against military pacts in Europe. To increase pressure in the West for the convening of a conference on security in Europe, the communist interest in which is to promote the dissolution of military pacts, the creation of a neutral, socialist Europe, and the withdrawal of the American military presence. To provide grounds for the future discrediting of Western statesmen, especially conservatives, and of Western diplomatic and intelligence services by misleading them over democratization, and by falsifying their assessments through the unexpected invasion of Czechoslovakia. To rehearse and gain experience for the repetition of democratization in Czechoslovakia, the Soviet Union, or elsewhere in Eastern Europe during the final phase of the long-range policy of the bloc.